This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
Hello and welcome to the Hope Mornings weekly podcast. I'm Katrina Rowe. Two of Sydney's leading businessmen, James Packer and David Gingell, made front page news this week. The friends of more than 35 years lost control of their tempers and had it out in the street. But what are the drivers behind malaggression and how can we talk about this constructively with our young boys? Steve Bidolf, author of The New Manhood and Raising Boys, shares his perspective. Did you know the northern hairy-nosed wombat is more endangered than the panda? Wombat lover and author of more than 140 books for young people, Jackie French, shares her passion for Australian wildlife and especially the humble wombat. 1 in 10 Australians suffer from asthma. Why is it so common in Australia and are we getting any better at managing it? Some great advice from the National Director of the National Asthma Council for World Asthma Day. Now, there has been heaps of great talent on the new season of The Voice.
Sometimes I feel like throwing my hands up in the air, yeah. I know I can count on.
But no one has been more impressive than Joanna Agella, our Hope 103.2 colleague. Hear her experience of being on the popular singing show. Rowena Beresford reviews both the first book and a movie of the New York Times best-selling trilogy, Divergence. And Andrew Webguy Morris helps you find the best cooking apps so you can spoil mum on Mother's Day. Finally, model, TV presenter and new mum, Rachel Finch, talks about how motherhood has changed her, what she'd love for Mother's Day and why she's lending her voice to Jeans for Jeans Day. That's all coming up on the Hope Mornings weekly podcast. Yesterday, the front page of the Daily Telegraph had a photo of James Packer and David Gingell trading blows. Packer had his fist up, Gingell was pulling on Packer's shirt, and the headline was Packer Whacker. Inside were blow-by-blow photos and descriptions of their manoeuvres. What is going on when two of Sydney's leading businessmen cannot control their tempers? Steve Bidolf is the author of The New Manhood and Raising Boys. Hi, Steve.
Hello, Katrina.
Yeah, now, is this sort of some remnant of, you know, macho Aussie culture when sort of men think that the way to solve their dispute is with their fists?
Oh, my guess about it, and I need to point out that everyone's only really guessing about this incident, and it's wrong to make definite conclusions about it. But my guess is that this certainly wasn't something that those two men consciously chose to do. Mm. And I'm sure that they're incredibly embarrassed and upset that it happened. And because I work with a lot of men, I'm aware of how dreadful that is to have had that happen. And one of the things that we need to realize about men's violence, that people often just think it's kind of self-indulgent anger, but most of the time it's actually caused by really acute anxiety. And when anxiety overwhelms us, we a part of our brain called the amygdala just basically takes over. Now, that doesn't excuse it, and we have to learn how to not let that happen, and we start to do that with our children when they're really small. Mm. But that's the mechanism, and so the most useful thing to look at is what were the stresses that those people were under, and how can they be helped better to manage those rather than trying to hammer your opponent into the pavement, yes.
Does it reflect, though, on the actual relationship, though, at all? I mean, because, you know, just in this example, these two people have been friends for a very long time. They're best man at each other's weddings, and yet it seemed like there was sort of an element of distrust. And this was really a misunderstanding that wasn't talked through well enough before it came to blows. I mean, how important is it for men and men in male friendships to be able to solve conflict more constructively?
Well, I think that this was very much a one-off, and I think that by far the greater violence risk with men, of course, and with women too, is domestic violence. That for every one of these headline-grabbing incidents, there's thousands every day involving men who hit their wives, or women who hit their children, or children who hit their parents, and so really, overcoming our natural tendency to violence is something that every single person has to do. We're all totally capable, if you think about it, of murdering people around us. And that's horrific, but it's always a power that we have. And so when you're raising very little toddlers, that's when we first start out to help them not to lash out and not to hurt other people. It's a really important part of parenting. And for kids, it's also one of the research findings is that it's very important they don't see violence. And so, for instance, a little boy who's hit by his parents is twice as likely to hit his spouse when he grows up. But if he sees domestic violence growing up, so a little child sees dad hitting mum when he's a child, he's seven times more likely to do that himself. Mm. And so there's no doubt where this comes from. It's role modeling and growing up in a frightened and frightening environment. And James Packer's father had really terrible anger outbursts.
Yeah.
Now, we don't think that's genetic. We don't think there's such a thing as a bad temper. It's simply that some men don't learn how to manage anxiety, and they express it by putting it onto other people.
Yeah, right. So it's really about getting to the heart of that anxiety and managing that.
Exactly, Katrina. And I think if we have more compassion about this kind of situation, then we can get in there and much better make sure it doesn't happen again.
And so maybe that's how we need to talk about it with our young boys and young men, if it is sort of coming up because it's in the media, is talking about it in those more compassionate terms instead of being judgmental about it.
Yes, and I think also we take out any hint of admiration, because there still is in the culture and a certain degree of admiration for people who knock other people over.
Yeah.
And so by putting it as kind of as a sad thing and something where a person has really has maturity issues or self-management issues.
Yeah, sure.
It becomes more able to treat it.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for explaining it a little bit more clearly this morning for us, Steve.
That's a pleasure, Katrina.
Yeah, Stephen Bidoff, psychologist and author of The New Manhood and Raising Boys. Jackie French is a prolific writer of books for children and young adults. As the author of the much-loved Diary of a Wombat, she's also a devoted protector of Australian wildlife, particularly the humble wombat. Her newest book is The Hairy-Nosed Wombats Find a New Home. Now, Jackie, how did you first develop a love of wombats and why do you love them so much?
The first time I saw one, I think it's impossible to see a wombat in the wild and not smile or laugh. When they're walking, their front end goes in one direction and their back end goes in another direction, and there is something just so intrinsically hilarious. And a wombat is always the centre of its own universe. you can never make a wombat embarrassed. If you say bad dog to a dog, it gets embarrassed and it's a shame. But if you say bad wombat to a wombat, it either ignores you or bites your ankle. A wombat could never, ever even conceive that they might have done the wrong thing.
Do you know, that is so true. My very first encounter with a wombat was actually in church when I was a little girl, and there was an Anglican church, you know, the full robes and everything, and this wombat, which was somebody's pet, but had wandered right up the aisle, went all the way up to the altar, and as you said, no sense of shame whatsoever.
So, possibly after dropping there as well. That's
right.
It is mine.
Oh, I've never forgotten it. It was hilarious. But look, it's not all hilarity. The northern hairy-nosed wombat, he's in pretty serious trouble, isn't he? Why is that?
There used to be lots of them, but with picky grazing, changes in grass types, predators like foxes, wild dogs, etc., the northern hairy-nosed wombat, for a long time, people thought they were extinct.
Mm.
And then a farm near Epping in the 1930s, a few were discovered. But when they were first counted, which was in the 1980s, there were only 35 of them. And most of those were male, and most of those were actually quite old males. So it really seemed as though there was really no hope at all for the northern hairy nose. But volunteers got together, and it really is an extraordinary good news story. Mm. The area where they lived was fenced and made it a vermin-free fence.
Mm-hmm.
They've been given watering stations, sometimes feeding stations. But basically, just by keeping their habitat safe, the wombats started to do what wombats are best at, eating, digging, and breeding baby wombats. Now, I'm a director of the Wombat Foundation. We raise money for research and also things like the DNA census mm-hmm. for the hairy-nosed wombats. And with the one that we paid for, the last one, in 2013, we haven't got the results yet, but it looks as though there are probably about 200 northern hairy noses. And
wow.
as I said, this isn't by doing anything major, no genetic engineering, no in vitro fertilization, just simply by leaving the wombats alone and letting them breed. And in fact, the wombats are breeding so fantastically now that attention has turned to finding a third site, either possibly extending the park at Epping, or more likely, finding a third place. Because even though the wombats are quite safe at Epping, where there is only one location for a critically endangered species, and these animals are more endangered even than the panda, they're very vulnerable if any single disaster happens.
Mm.
So that to have two places, and preferably at least three places, where there are wombats breeding really means a lot more security.
Yeah, because even though you've got a wonderful result there, 200 wombats is still very, very low numbers, isn't it?
It is, but when you think of what it was, 35, mostly male and mostly elderly, and now we've got 200, well, somewhere around 200, it shouldn't have been possible. By all criteria, the hairy noses really should have been so inbred that they weren't viable, that they had lots of physical problems, etc. But that's not been the case either.
Mm.
The hairy noses seem large and wombat-like. Wonderful diggers, wonderful leasers, wonderful procreators. They really are doing very well. But it also means that if we are to keep the success story going, we do need more funds. We need funds to do research on weeds that might kill them, on the buffel grass and how... well, the sorts of things that wombats really would like to eat and do best with, and also possibly to fence the third new home for northern hairy noses.
Mm.
But also the research that we do on northern hairy noses also has implications for other endangered species and also for other wombats. When I first joined the Wombat Association, we thought that the southern hairy noses were fine, no worries. And then they started to die from the most horrendous symptoms, and it took a lot of research to find out that it was because of weeds, introduced weeds.
Mm.
It just needed a very bad drought for the wombats to be so hungry they started eating things they'd never eaten before.
Yeah.
And it was killing them to an extent where it's possible that southern hairy noses may now be endangered too.
That really shows the value of support. Now, this Sunday, May 11th, it's Hairy-Nosed Wombat Day. What would you like people to do about Hairy-Nosed Wombat Day?
Wear whiskers for the day, or a day. Get your workmates to wear whiskers for the day, and get people to sponsor you for wearing whiskers. Whiskers for wildlife for a day.
Normally we try to get rid of our whiskers, Jackie.
I have to say, the whiskers that you make from brown wool, I have to say, they actually look rather impressive.
Mm.
That's very different from
okay.
the stash a female might normally be. very, very flattering, in fact, wearing.
That's so funny.
Wearing whiskers.
Oh, dear.
By the way, if you don't want to plait whiskers, you can just use a biro or something else to actually draw a moustache on your face.
Okay.
And it comes off with a little bit of soap in the afternoon.
Okay, that sounds good. Well, we've been speaking about Hairy-Nosed Wombat Day with Jackie French. Thanks for sharing a little bit of what you're learning through doing this role.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Yeah, that's author Jackie French. She's the author of more than 140 books, including Hitler's Daughter, the Fairy Named Freddy series, and Diary of a Wombat. Her newest book is The Hairy-Nosed Wombats Find a New Home, and all royalties from that book will be donated to wombat research and care. With more than 2 million Australians currently being affected by asthma, it's easy to get complacent about the disease. But World Asthma Day is a chance to encourage Australians to take control of the condition and live full, active, healthy lives. Stephen Hughes is the National Director of the Australian Asthma Council. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, how are you, Katrina?
Well, thank you. Stephen, why is asthma so prevalent in Australia?
Yeah, you're right. We are world leaders, unfortunately. I think there's a lot of associations with asthma that as opposed to cause and effect.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't actually have an absolute cause and effect type thing, but we do know there's a lot of things about living in Australia that means that we're sort of right up the top. And part of that is the temperate climate we have. So we've got lots mm-hmm. of molds, and we've got lots of introduced grasses and dust mites and things like that.
Yeah.
That's not the whole picture, obviously, because, you know, as a population, where we've got 10% of us that are overreacting to that. So most people can deal with it. But, you know, in some people's immune systems, they're just a little bit overreactive. Why is that? The research is still out there. We don't have a cure yet. But what I guess the good news is that it's treatable.
I mean, I've got a daughter with asthma, and people often say, oh, she'll probably grow out of it. Is it actually more common among children than adults?
It's not more common. It's probably actually slightly less common among children than adults. But we sit around the 10% for the whole population.
Mm.
And you're right. There's certain different, and I certainly won't go into the epidemiological subtypes.
Oh, well, thank you.
Because that's not my area of expertise. But there is certainly a portion of young children that do grow out of their asthma.
Yeah.
And there's others that don't. Where we're seeing some of the problems is actually in older people now, because potentially they're sort of saying, well, I just can't do what I used to do, not realising that they've developed asthma. So, you know, you can develop asthma at any age.
What are some of the common misconceptions that people have about asthma, Stephen?
One of the big ones is if you've got asthma, then you can't participate in sport and activity like anybody else. And that's one of the big misconceptions we really want to get as our message across today. Because we know if people are regularly participating in actively and in exercise, they are actually then enabled to take better control of their asthma. And that means less symptoms, it means less use of reliever medication. And it generally means an overall better quality of life and, you know, better happiness as well.
So in general, exercise is good for asthma, but maybe just not when you're actually having the asthma.
Well, when you're having an asthma attack or a flare-up, you can't exercise. But what we're saying is if your asthma is properly treated, then you should have the ability to exercise just like anyone else. And I think, you know, our Olympians are pretty much testament to that.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of them are, you know, world beaters at the top of their sport despite having asthma. So there's a couple of different, I sort of introduced a term there, reliever, and that's most commonly salbutamol. One of the brand names is Ventolin. And we have a real problem with people overusing their relievers and hence not treating the cause of asthma, which is underlying inflammation in your airways. So to treat that, you need an anti-inflammatory, which is a low-dose preventer for the majority of people.
So you're saying people will just use their reliever medication, their blue puffer, and you really want them on something that's a preventative.
Exactly, yeah. So ideally, if someone is being treated correctly and they're using their preventer daily and it's at the appropriate dose and everything, then there's very, very little need to use a blue puffer. And sort of looking at, you know, once or twice a week would be, you know, absolute maximum.
Okay. So are we getting better then at managing asthma and preventing, you know, deaths from asthma?
Depending what sort of time frame you're looking at, you know, over the last 20 years, sort of 20 years ago when the National Asthma Council started, we're looking at around about 1,200 or 1,300 deaths in Australia a year, which was, you know, certainly unacceptable.
Yeah.
Now it's just under 400, and it has been for the last few years. So we're really struggling to get that last little bit down. But yeah, so we have the technology to be able to do it. What we're missing is potentially the thought process in patients and carers thinking that it's serious. Now that we've sort of got these, you know, Ferrari technology medications, potentially people are saying, well, yeah, we're right now. We don't have to worry about it.
Okay.
But all our knowledge and research suggests that, no, that's actually not correct.
All right. So don't get complacent.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So if you're not doing the things that you should be doing, if you're saying, well, I can't run for the bus, or, you know, I can't go to the gym and all those sort of things, it means that your asthma is actually not well controlled. And long term, you could potentially be doing damage to your lungs.
Mm.
So I guess a bit of a rule of thumb is, you know, if you're having to use your blue inhaler more than, you know, a couple of times a week, or you wake at night with asthma, then you should be going back and getting reassessed, because there's a couple of, you know, big indications that things aren't as good as they should be.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for those tips today, Stephen. It's good to talk to you.
It's a pleasure.
That's Stephen Hughes. He's the National Director of the National Asthma Council. Today is World Asthma Day. You can find out more at nationalasthma.org.au. Still to come on the Hope Mornings weekly podcast, Rowena Beresford reviews Divergence, the young adult novel and movie. Andrew Webb-Guy-Morris helps you find the best cooking apps just in time for Mother's Day. And model and TV presenter Rachel Finch talks about motherhood. But now...
Sometimes I feel like throwing my hands up in the air, yeah. I know I can't count no more. Sometimes I feel like saying, Lord, I just don't care, yeah. But you got the love I need to see me through.
Now, there was heaps of good talent on the Voice Blind auditions last night, but nobody caught our attention like Joanna Aguilar. Now, we're not biased at all, but yes, she's on staff here as part of the sales team at Hope 103.2, and we're very pleased to have her with us in the studio. Hi, Joanna.
Hi, how are you?
Very exciting last night. Well done.
Yes,
congrats.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're all going a bit crazy about it here at work. Joanna, why did you decide to go on The Voice?
Well, it was actually my boss from my previous job who gave me a deadline to audition. Someone at work found out I could sing and they spread it like crazy throughout the company. They entered me into a competition at work and I won that talent quest. And yeah, so ever since then, they've just been pushing me to pursue that career.
They thought you were in the wrong job.
Yeah, they did. The CEO even said it. He's like, you're in the wrong industry.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's a nice compliment.
I think so.
Anyway, so how were you feeling before you walked on stage?
Oh, I was so nervous. Well, I've been waiting for this for a year because the year before the teams filled up. So I missed out just slightly, but they invited me back for this year. So I've been waiting a year. I was unprepared. I was prepared and ready to go.
And you're probably just so much better because you've had that extra year.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, to practice and everything. Okay, now look, I was watching it last night and I'm telling you, Joanna, it was stressing me out. The judges took a ridiculously long time to turn around. Were you starting to get worried?
I was. I was really worried. If you saw me on stage, I was happy when I got out and started performing to everyone, then realized no one was turning for me. So I just stood in one spot, gave it my all, just sang. I don't know. I just gave it everything and I was just really fighting and yeah, thankfully someone turned around in the end.
Did you think that, were you confident that they would or were you starting to feel
I was,
like?
I was really scared. Oh. I was nervous.
Yeah.
Nervous.
Well, you did in the end, you got you got Will I Am, you got Kylie Minogue, you got Joel. Why did you choose Will I Am?
Okay, I knew from the beginning that I would go with Will I Am. I thought about it before I even went on and I needed to make sure that I wasn't swayed by anything else. So he's more of the genre I'm in. I'm more soulful and
Now he made a big push for you, Joanna. He did a big pitch where he tried to appeal to your Filipino background. Let's hear what he had to say about that.
Okay. My best friend's Filipino.
Yeah. I know.
He's my best friend from growing up was Filipino.
Oh, okay.
my best friend in my group Black Eyed Peas is Filipino. It's as if you were sent here and I'm supposed to work with you for the Filipino people. Listen.
Now that is crazy talk, Joanna. Were you swayed by all that Filipino pride? Because I mean, I would personally think of you as Aussie.
I am Aussie. Yeah, but it is nice knowing that he supports the Filipino community, and it just made me feel a bit more comfortable and at ease on stage.
Yeah. I mean, he's a very funny guy, and I think that he will be a lot of fun to work with. Yeah. All right. Well, we're looking forward to seeing you in the battle round.
Yay! I can't wait.
We're all going to be there barracking for Joanna, and I'm sure that you're going to get through.
Thank you.
Yep. So that's Joanna.
I hope so.
Aguilar. And she was on The Voice last night. We are so proud of her. Joanna, all the best for that.
Thank you.
And watch The Voice for the next installment. Yay. I'm joined in the studio by my children's and young adult book reviewer, Rowena Beresford from Christian School Supplies. Hi, Rowena.
G'day. How are you going?
Now, today we're talking about the New York Times bestselling trilogy, Divergent, which right now is at the movies. So we're going to talk first about the book and then a little bit about the movies. Now, give us the basics of the plot of this one, Rowena.
No problem. Okay, so the main character is 16-year-old Beatrice, and with her brother, she's about to undergo the aptitude test. Now, they're in a society that's been split into five factions. It's kind of a post-apocalyptic Chicago setting. And the five factions, it's very interesting, and this is kind of the key to everything. The first is abnegation, whose main focus is selflessness. They value that above all else. Then there's erudite, who value knowledge, dauntless, who value courage, amateur, who value peace, and candor, who value honesty. The test is actually supposed to help them determine which of those five factions they should be in.
Okay, but it doesn't go to plan, or?
Well, although she was born in abnegation, and most of them end up in the faction that they were born to, she actually has inconclusive results and is told she must keep that secret because she's actually divergent, which is where the name of the book comes from. It means that she has three of those values, if you like, that come across very strongly in her test. And that is a very dangerous thing because people who have that are less easy to influence.
Okay, so that makes her a bit of a threat, does it?
That's right.
So this is another, you know, strong sort of female character with sort of a, you know, a kick butt sort of attitude, like Katniss and another sort of female characters we've seen in young adult fiction recently.
Yeah, she is. I mean, it takes her a little while to come into it. So because abnegation is all about selflessness, she's been raised in a way to not bring attention to herself. But what actually comes out is that she's more naturally quite a kind of strong and outgoing character. So she goes from being in a faction that is basically trying to hide and goes into a faction. She goes into Dauntless, and that faction is all about bringing attention to yourself.
Is there a lot of action in these books?
There is a lot of action. Dauntless are crazy. You know, although they value courage, what they've really become is risk takers.
Okay.
So they do a lot of kind of jumping off buildings and jumping off trains and things like that, but they're physically very intelligent, if you look at it in the multiple intelligences way, mm-hmm. and they do those things knowing they can do them.
Now, why has this book been such a big hit, Rowena?
Look, I think it raises some really interesting questions. It raises all the usual questions about belonging and finding out who you really are. But also there's some really deep underlying questions, you know, about the way that things can get out of balance. So even though each of those values are enormously fantastic and you would want them, if you have one without the others, things can really go wrong. And so what they find is that, you know, selflessness without courage can mean you're somebody who won't stand up when you need to. Courage without caring for other people can just become risk-taking, and in fact does. Honesty without compassion becomes cruelty.
That's really true, isn't it? And so, yeah, to be a balanced person, you need to have measures of all these things, although I guess we all have some, you know, strengths in some areas and not so much in others. It sounds like you're pretty on board with the books, that the books are really worth a read. Would that be right?
That's right. I have only read Divergent, the first one, and I've got the other two lined up to go, but I'm confident just from other people I've spoken to that they're good to go.
So there's no sort of major concerns in this that parents should be worried about?
No, not at all.
Or teachers?
In fact, when I was reading it, I was thinking to myself, there's some really interesting, you know, faith-based themes in these books. And when I got to the end, I discovered that the author, Veronica Roth, is actually a Christian. And you can really see that. She's very, in a really interesting way, allowed the story to tell that mm-hmm. without in any way trying to kind of poke it into anyone or stuff it down their throat kind of thing. So.
Okay. And how does that compare with the movie? The movie's at the cinemas right now. Is it worth the trip to the cinema?
Look, I was disappointed in the movie. Basically, I thought if you summarised the key points of the book and you threw away everything else, that would pretty much cover it. That's probably enough to get me assassinated by some young adults who I'm sure will absolutely love it. And my husband really enjoyed it, but he said when he walked out of the cinema, he forgot it. So it was enjoyable entertainment, but it didn't have the lasting, thought-provoking effect of the book.
That must be really disappointing for the author, mustn't it? You know, when they see the conversion losing kind of the real depth of the book.
Yeah, I think it must be really disappointing. I mean, I was disappointed as a reader and a lover of books. I just thought there was such great meat in this book, and the meat was lost in the translation. But it is still enjoyable. There's not really any problems with it. There's a little bit of violence and stuff. It's very low key. There is one boy who does kill himself, which isn't graphic, but you do see his body being brought up from the cliff. But there's a whole lot of reasoning around that in the book that's quite thought-provoking.
Okay. So it sounds like if you're going to go out and see the movie, it's probably worth picking up the book afterwards to sort of get the meat in the sandwich.
That's right. You'll get a lot more out of the book.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for filling us in on the Divergent trilogy this morning, Rowena.
You're welcome.
That's Rowena Beresford from Christian School Suppliers. We've been talking about the Divergent trilogy and also the new movie, which is at the cinemas now. A couple of weeks ago, we had a chat with Andrew Webb Guy Morris about the explosion in popularity of fitness apps. Well, this week we are looking at exploring cooking apps, because these days celebrity chefs don't just put out cookbooks, but they also put out apps for your tablet or your smartphone. Andrew's with us to review some of the best cooking apps on offer. Hi, Andrew.
G'day, Katrina. Good to be with you.
Not so long ago, I had a chat to Anne Reardon from the YouTube channel How to Cook That. She's become this absolute sensation on the internet. And it seems that cooking videos are really the latest thing. You know, it's not just enough to follow a recipe now. People want to see how
yes,
it's done.
Yes, and the development of apps, of course, for iPad particularly, that you can have something quite large in your kitchen to refer to. It's exploding, and there are so many cooking apps coming out now, particularly from well-known chefs who are creating beautiful, interesting apps with great and gorgeous photography, really easy to follow steps and lists of ingredients, and the how-to video. The how-to video is the core to many of these apps.
Andrew, if you could see the state of my cookbooks at home, though, you would understand why I don't actually use any cooking apps. How do you keep your iPad clean? Like, my book's always an app absolutely caked in food and, you know, slops.
Well, you can get protective covers for your iPad and all that kind of stuff. But, yeah, if I mentioned that I was going to bring the iPad into the kitchen with my wife, there'd be some serious discussions, because it would get messy and she'd have to clean it.
Yeah, so I don't know how people find their way around this, whether they just, you know, cook with gloves or they just wash their hands all the way through.
Well, it's a glass screen. How dirty can it get? You can clean it. But, I mean, there's so many website cooking and recipe websites. I mean, yes. Taste.com.au is probably one of the free, most well-known here in Australia.
Yeah, I use that a lot, yeah.
But, but there is a lot of free stuff and apps. And, again, we've spoken previously about in-app purchases, which for parents, particularly with kids' games, can be quite dangerous. But with cooking apps, you can either buy a chapter. You could buy a chapter on meat or fruit and veg or vegetable and nuts, or you buy the whole package. Stephanie Alexander, who is probably Australia's most well-known cookbook recipe celebrity person, has got The Cook's Companion. Which is a massive, massive book. And she has created, and her team, a beautiful app, a beautiful app. It's called The Cook's Companion. Over 2,000 recipes in it with videos, all broken down into different meats and vegetables, ingredients. And you've got your favorites. You can email those ingredients lists. You can make notes. You can search by ingredient. It's a really beautifully constructed app, along with, you know, Jamie Oliver. There's also the culinary fundamentals. So if you want to know how to julienne carrots or how to debone a chicken, you can watch MasterChef, but you can also get, you know, these apps which are done by professional chefs. And, like, there's one, Futura Group's Culinary Fundamentals, which I bought for my iPhone. You know, for $12, you're getting, like, 280 videos on how to cut up your meats and veggies and how to present and cook. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's really good for all the stuff that your mother didn't teach you. So what's one that you've been enjoying using, Andrew?
Okay, so for me, one of the ones that I'm a big fan of this American cookbook recipe person called Dori Greenspan. I did a trip to France and I thought, wow, that's awesome. So I looked for a good French cookbook and I found Dori Greenspan. And recently she's released her app. And it's again, it's broken into pastries, how to make a really good pastry and how to do desserts and all that kind of stuff. So I really enjoy her. She's a quirky older lady who's lived in Paris. So it's reasonably authentic. And it's simple. And again, it's inexpensive. For about $3 or $4, you're getting a great app.
Wow.
Whereas Stephanie Alexander, her app's awesome, but you're paying $60 for it.
And it's like going out and buying a cookbook. That would be a nice Mother's Day present.
Mother's Day. But you've got to be committed. For $60, you are getting virtually the book in app form.
Okay. Well, look, since this weekend is Mother's Day, I think that we need to get a recipe from one of these apps, something that any guy could cook for his wife, or maybe even your teenage son could do this for you, ladies, if you're a single mum. Andrew, what have you picked today?
Okay, so I recently found a great cafe in Petersham, which does this French dessert, if you like. It's like an open apple pie. So it's the tarte tartan.
Okay, the tarte tartan.
So basically, it's really, really simple. All you need is some butter, some sugar, apples, and some puff pastry. Okay. You need some kind of frying pan or skillet that you can put in the oven. So on the top of your gas or electric hob, you know, mm-hmm. you put in some butter, get it all warmed up and hot. You put some sugar in, and then you lay down cut apples and tightly
chunky.
Cut up face down. Make sure that's tightly packed in because they'll shrink as they get hot. So once that's caramelizing and looking really good, get some puff pastry, put it over the top of the skillet, and tuck it in around the edges.
Okay,
whack it in the oven.
Sounds simple so far.
Let it do its business, and then bring it out. And the magic of the tarte tartan is when you flip it. So you've got to flip it over.
You've got to umpty do it. This is what my mother would say. This is the crucial part of any baking. Let's hear what Dory Greenspan does on the in the video app. Yeah.
I'm ready. You ready? 1, 2, 3. Over.
There she is. Umpty
she's
doing
so cute.
It. Did it work?
Oh, it's gorgeous.
Awesome. So, yeah, so that's Dory Greenspan showing you step-by-step how to make a tarte tartan. And it's great. It's very easy. And that's the beauty of cooking apps and that kind of stuff.
So what's her app called?
Baking with Dory Greenspan.
But there's
free ones. Evernote is a well-known note-taking app. They have got Evernote Food, which is where you can find cafes and restaurants. You can make your own notes, save your own recipes in there, and also search for recipes. It's a free app. Epicurus have a free app as well, which is worth checking out. And if you're a vegetarian or you want healthy eating options, there's the Green Kitchen app, which is a paid app, and the Whole Pantry, which has in-app purchases, which is really worth checking out.
Okay, that's Andrew Webgo-Morris. We've been talking about cooking apps, fellas. Maybe you could use one to cook something for the special mum in your life this weekend. 1 in 20 Australian children will be affected by a genetic disease. New mum and television presenter Rachel Finch has just been announced as ambassador for Genes for Genes Day, which raises money for the Children's Medical Research Institute. Hi, Rachel.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. Now, Rachel, I understand you've had your first baby, Violet, in September last year. So
yes.
Are you looking forward to your first Mother's Day?
Oh, yes. I'm so excited. She's 7.5 months, 8 months on the 24th of May. So really super excited. She's just discovering her mouth and all her facial features. So I would love a real kiss.
A real kiss. Oh, it's so lovely, all those firsts. I remember the first time my second daughter said, "I love you," and I was just,
I would imagine that would be a heart-melting moment.
Yes, absolutely. Now, has motherhood changed you, Rachel?
Absolutely. More so than anything, it's made me a more relaxed person. I'm a quite organised person.
What you're saying, Rachel, is you were an overachiever. Come on, all this Miss Universe and everything.
I just like to, you know, kind of be here, there and everywhere on the go. But ever since having Violet, you kind of just take a step back and think, wow, you know, this is the epitome of our existence. It's the reason we're here. It's just such a beautiful, humble thing to do and experience. And I think it just makes you more grounded and well-rounded and happy.
It is lovely just to step back and have a slower pace of life for a bit, isn't it?
Yeah, and just to spend time just doing nothing, just watching her and making her happy.
Yeah, beautiful. Has it made you appreciate your own mother more?
Absolutely. You know, especially through the first 10 weeks of life when it's the night feeds and the breastfeeding and the, you know, I was a girl that needed 10 to 12 hours of sleep a night, so that quickly changed. But when you're raising a child and you understand what your mother and your father have gone through, there's so much more appreciation and respect that you have for them.
Mm. You've just been announced as a Genes for Genes ambassador, and I guess when you have a baby, you do appreciate the miracle of life, don't you? When how that everything comes together and it, you know, your body just knows what to do, and it's just amazing. Mm. What made you want to get involved in Genes for Genes Day, Rachel?
Well, that first and foremost reason, the fact that I am a new mum, and imagining anything happening to Violet is is quite scary and nerve-wracking. So anything to be able to help raise awareness about raising funds, about the research involved for Genes for Genes, and, you know, to help people understand why the research has been undertaken. And one in, as you said, one in 20 Australian children are affected. So if you break it down, that's one child in every classroom. So it's a pretty alarming fact. And it's close to my heart.
So what are some of the good things that medical research can achieve? I know the Children's Medical Research Institute has been doing research since 1958. It's a long time. What's some good things that funds raised help to achieve?
Well, some medical breakthroughs achieved through the funds raised by Genes for Genes are things like increasing the survival rates of premature babies, establishing Australia's first research unit for newborns, and important things like introducing vaccines that protect against a number of potentially fatal childhood diseases. So things that are constantly on our radar in cancer, epilepsy, anything that's related to DNA, you know, birth defects that are DNA related, you know, at the forefront of research. So it's just really nice to be able to put my voice behind it.
How can people get involved in supporting Genes for Genes Day?
So, of course, the first and foremost is to wear your jeans on the first Friday in August, which is August the 1st this year. But we're calling out for people to jump on board jeansforjeans.org.au and become a fundraising genie. So basically you can do anything you'd like. You can get as creative as you like to find ways to fundraise money. So whether it be hold a little tea party at your work, you can put on a yoga morning, you can put on a little mini fashion parade at work, you know, get all your girlfriends together for a luncheon, whatever you like to get people together to raise money.
Yeah, you could go with a double denim theme. That would be really cool.
My boss came in the other day wearing double denim, and I'm thinking, have you been briefed on my role as Jeans for Jeans? Very good.
It's just showing your support, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thanks so much for filling us in. Obviously, now's a good time for people to jump on board and register. Thanks so much for telling us about it, and congrats on being a new mum, and I hope you really enjoy your first Mother's Day, Rachel.
Thanks, Katrina. Really appreciate it.
That's television presenter and new mum, Rachel Finch. We've been talking about Genes for Genes Day on Friday, August 1st. Registrations are open now at Genes for Genes. That's the denim type of jeans first in the spelling and then the DNA type. So jeansforjeans.org.au.